Okay, so let's pick up where we left off 2 weeks ago when we were speaking. And we started by trying to track the development of Torah from Moshe to the Mishnah. And we went over different categories, the transmission of Torah, as well as the different categories of dinim that you may find in the Mishnah, and how clearly those things came from Moshe. So we're going to quickly recap what we said and build upon that as we explore the next stage of Torah development in history, which is, after the Mishnah, is the Gemara. Exactly. So last week, two weeks ago, we dealt with how do you get from whatever Moshe Rabbeinu got at Har Sinai to what we see in the Mishnah. But now it seems like all the, you know, seems like the levees are breaking and just everything is, you know, how do I say this? It just seems like it goes, it like spirals into craziness when you get into the Gemara. You can no longer track a very clear, you know, oh, Moshe got these dinim, he passed over these dinim, and then I'm reading them in the Mishnah, and maybe there's a debate about them. Right? Because the Gemara just seems like it's all over the place. So we're going to try to make a little bit of clarity. Basically, what we mentioned was there are roughly five different categories of laws that you might find in the Mishnah. That's a little bit of a simplification. Not everyone agrees that there are five categories or how we define the five categories. But again, we want to keep things on the simpler side just so we can get the picture. And then if we ask questions, if we want to know more, I'll try to detail some of the nuances a little bit more. So what we mentioned is, what types of things could be in the Mishnah? Well, Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah Shebichtav and he wrote that down, and that is what we have now. Now, those psukim that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote were explained to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe then taught those explanations to Klal Yisrael and most significantly to Yehoshua. In addition to the psukim, and in addition to the explanations of those psukim, we have certain laws that are not mentioned in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu gave us, and that's called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. Okay, so we have laws in the Torah, Shebichtav. We have the explanations of those laws that Moshe Rabbeinu passed down to us, and most particularly to Yehoshua. And then you have specific laws that don't appear in the Torah, and that is called Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. In addition, Moshe was taught how to read the Torah to extract the subtext, to extract the not the apparent implication of the text, but the not so apparent implication of the text, or not the blatant meaning of the text, but the implication of the text. Maybe that's a little bit better. Okay? Now, there are 13 primary tools that Moshe Rabbeinu would use to extract the implication of the text that isn't apparent from its from the words, necessarily. Right? What do we call those 13 rules, 13 tools? Close. It's very confusing because there are two Yud Gimel Midot in Judaism, right? There are the Yud Gimel Midot HaRachamim, that's what we say about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then there's Yud Gimel Midot SheHaTorah Nidreshet Bahem, right? And that is what we say in the morning in the name of Rabbi Yishma. Okay? These are the primary tools by which we can read the Torah and see not necessarily what's written, but what's behind what's written. So the clearest example or examples would be a Kal V'Chomer. So the Torah tells you a certain law. And if that is the law, you can infer that all the more so something else is the law. It kind of works like the Torah says, you know, someone who is this tall can ride the roller coaster. So maybe you want to infer, well, then someone 2 inches taller could also ride the roller coaster. You know, unless there's like a height limit, whatever it is. But that's how that works. Now, it isn't written about the second person, but you can infer from the first person about the second person. Alternatively, if you have the exact same word used strategically in two similar contexts of halacha, you can learn some of the laws around one of the words to the other word. You have a circumstance, let's say you have, you know, let's say we're discussing Sukkot and Pesach, and their similarity is obvious, they're two of the regalim. Okay? And the Torah describes them in similar ways, like talking about the night of the 15th, when they both start. So because they use the same word, and because they're discussing similar ideas, we learn some laws about Pesach to Sukkot. Okay? That's what's called a, does anyone know? That's a Gzeirah Shavah. Gzeirah Shavah requires an element of Mesorah, because you can't just link any two words and equate the dinim, because then you could just go anywhere with that. A Gzeirah Shavah. Gzeirah Shavah. Right? Yeah.
Can we go through the
Yod Gimel Midot? If we have time in a later shir. Yeah. I could definitely send you sources on it. I have source sheets just going through the explanations of all the Yod Gimel Midot. And also all the Lamed Bet Midot. There are 32 rules when it's not particular to Halacha, but other ways of extrapolating ideas, let's say, from the text. Some of the Midrashim, which compare stories and suggest all these ideas about the Avot that you never would have thought of, like, those aren't halachic tools, but they're midrashic tools. Right. So it's extremely difficult to use them personally, but it definitely helps to appreciate where the Perushim come from. I would say that. Okay, so those are called the Yud Gimel Midot. So now we have basically laws that are explicit in the text. Okay, we have laws that are explanations of the text. We have laws that are Halacha L'Moshe MiSinai. Right, we have laws that are learned from the Yud Gimel Midot. Now, according to the Geonim, according to many of the Geonim, so this is before the Rishonim, nothing. Fine, yeah, so according to the Geonim, before the Rishonim, it's very likely, or very possible, that some of what Moshe was taught and passed down between the seal of the Gemara, or especially between the compilation of the Mishnah, and Moshe Rabbeinu actually having received these laws, some things were forgotten, and some things we lost clarity on, and that would account for some of the debates that you see in the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah is not just a clear, you know, recounting of, and then Moshe received this, and then Moshe received that, and then Moshe received this. Some things are debated. And there are those who attribute those debates to things that we forgot, things that were lost, or things that we lost clarity on in terms of their details over time. The Rambam, as we said, does not like that answer, and he assumes that we held on to everything Moshe Rabbeinu taught us extremely well, and the debates that we find in the Mishnah can be attributed to different people using different tools of extrapolation differently. We said there are 13 tools, and maybe even more than the 13 tools, but the 13 primary tools for reading the text and extrapolating additional laws from it to kind of get the subtext or the implication of the text. You can have two rabbis who read the text and extract different potential explanations or different potential implications of the text. Says the Rambam, that's where the argument comes from. We preserved everything we received exceptionally well, but those tools are not telling us explicitly what to do. They're tools for reading, for learning. As long as they followed these rules, then their opinions were recorded in the Mishnah, based on the conclusion that they drew. At a later class, we're going to go a little bit more in depth on understanding Jewish machloket, Jewish debate. Like why we would ever see two things as potentially accurate when wouldn't God probably have one thing in mind? Or how could it be that two people can be following different laws and we think that's totally fine? And they're both correct. I mean, it's a difficult concept. We'll go into that at a later date, but now we just got to deal with the Gemara. Okay? So these are the, that's regarding Machloket. Lastly, we mentioned that you also have the layer of Derabbanan. Everything up until now is basically Deoraita. Okay? Either explicit in the Torah Shebichtav, or explicit in the Torah Shebaal Peh, or extracted from the Torah Shebichtav, which, for simplicity's sake, we'll just say we treat that as a Deoraita, but there are some fascinating nuances between the whether it's clear or extrapolated. But for our purposes, let's just say everything up until now, we're talking about the level of Deoraita. But that only covers one level within our laws, right? Because we have rabbinic laws. So you have rabbinic laws that are formulated, rabbinic laws like a mitzvah, midirabbanan. The Torah has mitzvahs, the rabbis have mitzvahs. How many mitzvahs do the rabbis have? Seven. They have seven mitzvot. Yeah. They have only seven mitzvot. Everything else that the rabbis basically do, everything else that they do is a preventative means around the Torah in order to preserve something.
What are those seven?
I don't know that I know the top of my head. It's Hadlakat Nerot, Netilat Yadayim, Brachot, Megillah, Ner Chanukah, Erevin maybe, and like one other one. I don't remember the top. What? Yeah, like these are like specifically rabbinic mitzvot. There's one other one that I'm drawing a blank on, but there are seven rabbinic rabbinic inventions of mitzvot. The other one is it Hallel? Might be Hallel. Anyway, I don't remember exactly, but that is the. Those are the seven. Now, the everything else is built off the Torah. We either have a doubt, and so the rabbis give us some sort of guidance in doubt, or we have a law that's quite easy to break. And so the rabbis give us some sort of preventative means from breaking it. So those are the different types of dinim that you might find in the Mishnah, and how we got there. Okay. Now, what we need to discuss now is the Gemara, and what it does. And the Gemara is really the funnel from something of a clear tradition and specific laws to everything that came later, and the massive amounts of Svarim that we see in our Batei Midrash. The Gemara focuses on three primary questions, at the very least in the halachic parts of the Gemara. Okay, there are other parts of the Gemara that tell stories, or teach points, or go on tangents. So those are that's the agadic part of the Gemara. In the halachic part of the Gemara, we focus on three primary questions. We bring in the Mishnah, and then we deal with one, two, or three primary questions on that Mishnah, and I'll explain why. Each of the categories that we mentioned of laws in the Mishnah work differently. And it makes sense that a Torah law should perhaps work differently than a rabbinic law. I think that we can all agree that there is some logic to that. Can you name me a difference, perhaps, between a Torah law and a rabbinic law? Okay, punishments that you would get if you break them. There are also different punishments within Torah laws. There's a hierarchy of punishments within Torah laws. What are some other differences, perhaps, between Torah laws and rabbinic laws? Yeah. Excellent. So there's a general rule when it comes to a rabbinic law that if we have a doubt, we are lenient. And a general rule when it comes to a Torah law that when we have a doubt, we are stringent. Now, it's not so clear whether it's the Torah telling us to be stringent with a Torah law or it's the rabbis telling us to be stringent with a Torah law. But that's just one of the differences. So it's important to know not just what the law is, but where it comes from. And in fact, all categories of laws work a little bit differently. Even within the rabbinic realm, it works differently. Why? Because let's say the rabbis said, you know, the rabbi said this was the law. Okay? What could be a difference that you might suggest between different rabbinic laws? Why would it be important to know exactly where this law came from?
Right.
When the rabbis formulated this law, did they formulate it objectively and eternally? Or were they addressing a specific time period or a specific problem? In which case, in a different time period and in a different problem, could you theoretically revisit that law and question its relevance to your time? Right. So that's why it would be important to know where this law came from. Could be different based on where you're living in Minhag HaMakom. So it's extremely important, obviously, to differentiate between Torah laws and rabbinic laws, but also what type of Torah law and what type of rabbinic law. I'll give you another example. Even if something is from the Torah, okay, if the Torah didn't say this straight out, okay, if the Torah doesn't say this straight out, then there could be a question of to what degree is this objective? I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Okay, the Torah says that you may not kindle a flame on Shabbos. Okay, that will always be the case and in every context, because the Torah literally says it straight out. Don't kindle a flame on Shabbos. So guess what? You can never kindle a flame on Shabbos. Okay, but let's say the Torah said something along the lines of, men and women, you know, can't wear women's clothing, and a woman, you know, can't don men's vessels. Okay, what is women's clothing, and what are men's vessels? Okay, so let's say, for example, pants. Now, are pants men's clothing? Probably at a certain time, they were uniquely men's clothing. In which case, you might find in halacha that it would be a problem of beged ish, or clay gaver, more specifically, a problem of clay gaver for a woman to wear pants. Now, would that be a deoraita problem? Well, the Torah is the one telling you not to do it. In which case, yes, it is a Torah-level issue. But does the Torah say you can't wear pants? No, it says don't put on men's things. So let's walk through this process. As long as these are men's things, what's the issue here? A Torah issue. Okay, and is the Torah eternal? Of course the Torah is eternal. But it may not be eternal that we define pants as men's things. Everyone follow that? Now, there are other problems before you get too excited. There are other problems with wearing pants. But specifically the problem of donning men's kalim, so that would be one example. Now, a classic example is, you know, men used to not be allowed to look in mirrors. It's an explicit gemara. Explicit gemara in the Masechet Nidah. Men are not allowed to look in mirrors. Okay, is that a rabbinic problem or a Torah problem? It seems to be a Torah problem because this was a distinctive woman practice. In which case, it is a Torah level issue, and the Torah never changes. So how can men ever look in mirrors? Because the Torah didn't say men couldn't look in mirrors. The Torah said men couldn't do distinctive woman practices. At such a time where this is a distinctive woman practice, then it is a Torah level problem. If this is not a distinctive woman practice, then it would not be a Torah level problem. So it was a little bit complicated, but everyone follow what I said? There's a difference between something that's written explicitly and something which is an application of something which is written in the Torah. For that reason, it's extremely important to know what the source of the law is. Because how the law works and how it functions, right, is going to differ based on where it comes from. Okay? Now, why is it so important to know how the law works and how it functions? well, here's a problem that many religions and even different sects of Judaism run into. There is, on the one hand, a need within any religion to adhere strictly and absolutely to anything that you would have received from heaven. I mean, is that like a fair assessment of religion? Like, if you're a religion and you believe that God told you to do certain things, so you can pretty much stake your religious legitimacy by, are you doing those things? Because if God wants you to do them or not to do them, and you are not listening, this is your faith? Meaning, like what? So you want to adhere to that. Okay? But a difficulty that people run into is that the time where we have the divine revelation, or the supposed divine revelation, depending on whether your religion is true or not, the time where you have the divine revelation and the time you're currently in are not just many, many, many years apart, but they're almost incomparable circumstantially. Almost incomparable circumstantially. And so some things which may seem archaic or wrong, you need a way of sorting out whether it was somehow a product of the time it was given in, and it might be legitimate to behave differently, or whether it was an eternal edict, and the fact that you see it as wrong today is not because of the mistakes of the God who gave it, but that perhaps your assessment of morality today is off. How do you work that out? And even without a particular problem, how do you make sure that you're serving God as authentically in a period of time 3,000 years after he gave you the last instruction as they were in the period where he gave the instructions? Some things are just so dissimilar. It's not like, well, this bothers me ethically. It's just, I don't know how to do that because I don't have any of those things. So the damage laws discussed in the Torah are discussed in the context of animals. Okay? An ox gores XYZ. Here are the damage laws. Would the same apply to a car? We don't have oxen walking around, and they're not responsible for most of the damage that are happening to people. Car accidents, though, relatively common. Are the two comparable? You need a system that you're able to learn not just how the law was formulated, okay, but what's behind the law. Because if you know how the law is formulated, then you know what to do in a circumstance where an ox comes and gores somebody else. But if you know what the principle of the law is, then you know how to figure out any case where somebody's property damages somebody else. That's extremely important if you hope to be a religion that is both completely adherent to the divine word and also practically able to function in any place and any time. And this is a problem that a lot of sects and a lot of religions run into, is there's no code about how to set a balance there. How progressive to be and how conservative to be. Right? Do we throw everything away to keep up with the times? Or do we ignore the changing of the times in order to adhere to the divine? And that's why you have these fundamentalist, extremist sects of certain religions who can't function in today's world and are a hazard to everyone around them. Okay, and you also have these progressive sects of religions that honestly probably have nothing to do with the original dogma of their faith. Okay, and then you have Judaism that has or at least Orthodox Judaism, that has a calculated
balance and system as to how to preserve everything divine and update only that which is circumstantial in our legal system. We call that system the Gemara. Let's walk through how the Gemara does that. The Gemara, like I said, asks three questions, primarily on the Mishnah. It introduces the Mishnah, and then it will generally ask, okay, the Mishnah said, this is the law. X is the law. I want to know, what is the source of that law? It makes sense, I want to know what the source is. Meaning, if it's Deoraita or Derabbanan, I want to know. To know how to treat it and what the implications are.
Is that number one?
Yeah, that's question number one. But it doesn't always ask it in this order, but I'm generalizing. And it doesn't always ask all the questions. What's the source? Is it Deoraita, Derabbanan? If it's Derabbanan, what type of Derabbanan? If it's Deoraita, what type of Deoraita? The categories work differently than one another. Okay? Is it explicit in the Torah? Is it learned out from the Torah? Is it one of the Gimel Mito? Is it an application of something instead in the Torah? If it was rabbinic, was it made eternally? Was it made circumstantially? How does that work? What is the source? Okay? The second question is how the law works. Like I said, the different laws work differently. Okay, well, how does this law work? Once I've figured out where it comes from, I want to know the particulars of how it works. And I'll give you some examples. There's a very widely learned chapter in the Masechet called Bava Batra. It's the third perek, and it deals with chazakot. Okay, it deals with the following topic. Okay, if you own a land, if you are the owner of a land, and someone else comes in and says, "What are you doing here? This is my house." Something which, you know, probably used to happen a little bit more. What are you doing here? This is my house. And you say, your house? I live here. I've been living here. What do you mean? I don't even know who you are or where you came from. And then you go to Beit Din, okay, and the first question they're going to ask the current occupant of the house is, how long have you been here? How long have you been here? Okay? Because is a good question. But let's just work this out practically for a second. If you could say, 3 months! I've been here for 3 months! The other guy might say, it's on vacation! Like, what do you want from me? I was, like, you know? And if you say, I was here for a year! I was here for a full year! And you'd be like, I was taking my gap year! You know, like, if you claim and then can bring witnesses to the fact that you have been here for 3 years, at that point you have what we call a chazakah, where the default, the assumption is, this home is yours. The other person can try to argue it, try to bring it, but if you can claim and bring witnesses to the fact that you have been there for 3 years, the default law is that it's probably yours. Still a little bit more back and forth, but that's how we decide who has to bring the next proof. Okay. Meaning if you were there for one year, meaning couldn't you have bought it a year ago and then were there for a year and, you know, and so yes, you don't lose it, but if you haven't been there for 3 years, then the burden of proof is on you. To prove that you bought it, and okay. Once you've been there for 3 years, the burden of proof is on the other guy. That is a chazakah. Fine. But the question that the Gemara asks, what's the source of that law? It's important to know what the source is. Because if the source, let's say hypothetically, the source was a what we call a gzeirat hakatuv. Torah says 3 years. Or we learn it out from this place in the Torah. Like an ox gores 3 times, then we call it a damaging ox. Oh, there we see, after 3, something changes. That's the Torah. Okay, well that's where we learned that law has major implications for how we think the law works. Because if it says it explicitly in the Torah, you can't really imagine a scenario where it wouldn't be 3 years. Okay? But what if it was a svara? What if it was a logical argument? Okay? And the logical argument, you know, works like this. Nobody is going to watch you act like you own their property for 3 years and not say anything. Okay, then it's a question of why three. Good question. But let's just say, no one's just going to sit back and watch you pretend to be the owner of their property for 3 years and not say anything. It's not going to happen. Okay, so if you're in a field and you've been in that field for 3 years, we assume that no one's just going to not say anything about that. Well, what if you only planted in the second year? Or what if you planted in the first year and in the third year? Could the original owner come in and say, you know, this is my field? And then the occupant would say, what? You mean I've been here for 3 years? Oh, 3 years should be his. But maybe then the original owner could say, what? I only saw you planting it twice. Now you're planting it for a third time and I'm coming to protest. Could he say that? So that depends on where the law comes from. If the law is 3 years, 3 years is 3 years, then we don't really care how many times he planted it. 3 years is 3 years. But if the law is based on how many times would a person stay silent if he sees you acting like you own his field? Three. Oh, okay, well, you only planted twice, so he can still argue. Right? You see, the point I'm trying to make is you can draw a link between the source of the law and how that law works. The source of the law and how it works. Is it objective? Is it subjective? Is it based on time? Is it not based on time? Could it change? Does it not change? What's its capacity to change? Could it be A, B, or C, or is it totally amorphous? What are the relevant considerations in what this law could look like 500 years down the line when our circumstances are different? Those are questions about how the law works. How the law works. And that's extremely important, because if you only know what the law is, then you only have the capacity to fill a Kadosh Baruch Hu's ratzon for as long as your circumstances are identical to those of the Torah. Okay, but if your circumstances are not identical to those of the Torah, you need to know not what the law is, right? But what this law, what God wants for me intrinsically, and how that would look in a limitless amount of contexts that we couldn't even predict all of them 2,000 years ago. We just have to clarify the principle clear enough so that when the circumstance does come up, the rabbis in that circumstance will say, well, we know the principle. Let's plug in the circumstances like an algorithm and see what God wants for us. But with only the law and not the principle behind that, we can't work that out. So that's the issue. Then, what's question number three? Question number three is about basically, once we clarify the source and then how it works, we're going to ask a couple different scenarios that incorporate this law to determine whether or not the law looks different in those scenarios than it was formulated in the Mishnah. And why do we do that? So we have examples for how the law can morph in different situations. Right, so that Gemara in Bava Batra then starts asking all of these questions. What about this type of field? What about that type of field? What about a field that you plant in every 3 months because it grows like weeds? You know, then do you get it in 3 months? What about... And it asks again and again and again and again. Different circumstances. And then it uses the how does this law work in order to understand what that law the Mishnah spoke about looks like in a context that was different than what the Mishnah spoke about. So by the end of the Gemara, what exactly do we have? Okay, well, we have all the laws from the Mishnah. We have the source for all the laws within the Mishnah. We have the source for all the laws within the Mishnah. Okay, we have an elucidation of how those laws work, right? And then we have a subset of examples of what that law looks like in sufficiently different contexts than the Mishnah was speaking about. That basically gives us a blueprint for how to be able to follow God's will eternally and in any given circumstance. Because all that needs to happen now is that the circumstance will come up. And of course, the Gemara probably didn't discuss this circumstance, but you want to know, is this a relevant law at all in this circumstance? Or what exactly does this law look like in this circumstance? How do I follow God's instructions in this circumstance? You see this all the time with Shabbos, for example. With the development of technology, trying to figure out, does this break Shabbos? Does that break Shabbos? Well, you have to know what the law is. Okay? The Torah says you can't cook. Well, I mean, Mideoraita, you can't cook on Shabbos. Okay? Mideoraita, you can't cook on Shabbos. Now, for a very long time, we kind of just accepted that, okay. But then, slowly we started developing a lot of different ways of cooking. And we had to ask about them, does this meet the criteria that the Torah was talking about when it said cooking? I'll give you an example. We didn't ask a lot of these questions for a while. But, I don't know, someone tried to define cooking for me in like a technical way. Using an oven. That's an example. I want a definition.
Something that's raw that you that now becomes edible.
Turning something from raw to edible. Okay? What if I could turn something from raw to edible by putting it in salt for 3 days? By curing it? By... Is that cooking? Yeah.
I don't get how, like, things like ramen or, like, things like that are, like, edible, like, aren't, like, okay to have on Shabbos. Because, like, no one's eating, like, those dried up noodles. And those are, like,
That's a great question. It's a great question. It's a question which is extremely pertinent to what we're talking about. Okay?
It's the powder from the noodles.
Because this is not a halacha shir, I'm going to try to... We can stick around afterwards, and I can tell you all the considerations when it comes to noodle soups and whatnot. But I'll just say it like this in the meantime, okay? Let's say we defined cooking as turning something raw into edible. Let's say that was our definition. That's not the definition I would take necessarily, or not the full definition, but let's say that was our definition, okay? Are the noodles in the package raw?
No.
They've already been cooked.
They're
cooked. Right, so then how can you apply cooking to it? You're not turning something from raw to cooked. So it all depends on your definition of cooking. Again, no, there are a lot of considerations here. I did not just say all the considerations when it comes to making those
like a heat source, like using right? heat source.
Amazing. We need to, you know, we need to, so use a heat source to turn something from raw to edible. Okay? Okay? So, that's another great question. Rav Kook says it's Eish. Most poskim don't really say it's Eish. The Chazon Eish thinks it's building because you're connecting circuits. Most poskim don't think it's building. Rav Shlomo Zalman thinks it's Derabanan, and that's pretty much how we hold. But again, this isn't a halacha shir, so I'm just trying to give the outline. See, we have to work out these definitions for how it works in order to then apply the laws to the current situation. Okay, so heat. So we just said heat source. I mean, cooking that the Torah says is usur. It involves, let's say, changing something from unedible to edible, and maybe that's a more broad term, because if you say raw, then those noodles don't. But could you say that those noodles are unedible? I don't know, maybe they would be edible. Okay, these are the discussions. Let's say we said changing something unedible to edible through heat. Okay? You know what doesn't classically use heat for cooking in the normal sense? Microwaves. Okay, how do microwaves cook? With microwaves, right? Not through fire. Okay, so there's a discussion around, should microwaves be considered cooking on a Torah level? It's not using heat.
It's not, it's electricity.
So it's a problem of electricity, but it's not a problem of cooking.
But it gets hot.
Why does it matter? I can tell you why it matters. First of all, it could be a question of deoraita or derabanan, because it's electricity, and electricity is only derabanan. So then you have whether it's deoraita or derabanan. That's number one.
But you're still violating law.
What?
You're
definitely still violating law, but as we said in the beginning, there are differences as to whether or not the law is rabbinic or from the Torah. What if there's a doubt around this? What if someone, you know, came in and said, I made this this delicious meal for Shabbos. And by the way, I made it on Shabbos. Okay? So, there's a difference there as to whether or not they violated a rabbinic law in order to make that food, or they violated a Torah law in order to make that food. Now, doesn't it matter whether or not we define...
But are you still not allowed to eat it either way?
They're not allowed to eat it either way. Right? And if it was done uniquely for you, you're not allowed to eat it either way. But someone for whom it wasn't done may be able to. Especially if it's a rabbinic violation. There are all these considerations. There are all these considerations that you need to take into account. That's where the law comes from and how the law works. Right, so that's in terms of cooking. Also, let's say you're making something in a sous vide, okay? That takes 2 days to make, right? But you cook it at a temperature of like 75 degrees, okay? Is that heat? What's the minimum temperature that we're going to define as heat? Well, a cholent definitely is pretty hot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But there's no fire.
Yeah,
you
have to let it go.
Well, there's no... Right, so can you... Let's say you're making salmon in a sous vide. You can very comfortably put your hand in there.
It's a yacht.
Okay, so it's... In Celsius, it's 43. And in Fahrenheit, I think it's like 109. Is like the minimums that we discuss. But there are temperatures that you can cook in a sous vide that does not meet the minimum temperature for Yad So Let It Bo. So again, it's all, we have to know where the law comes from, how the law works, and then we can start figuring out, okay, does it apply here, 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 here? Is this bishul? Is that bishul? Is this bishul? Is that? Now, they already spoke about this in the Gemara because they had tremendous foresight. Tremendous foresight. And we're just using the principles that they discussed. You know what they discussed in the Gemara that's extremely helpful for us to work out all these questions? What if you cooked by something that was heated up by the sun? They discussed this in the Gemara.
That's
disgusting. It is... Here's how it works.
Like an
sun for a really long time, you do that, you put an egg in the sun.
Right. So how do we treat that? The Gemara talks about this. The Gemara talks about this. You know, you want to know what the Gemara says? If you cook it directly by the sun, totally mutter.
Really?
100% mutter. That is not at all the bishul the Torah was discussing. Totally mutter. If you cook it in something that was heated up by the sun, like a tray, derabanan.
So if I just put an egg on the floor, it's fine. But if I have a pan and then the egg, then it's fine.
Well, it's a problem derabanan because we're concerned that you're not going to be able to differentiate between a pan that was heated up by a fire or the sun.
What do you consider?
But on a Torah level, they're both fine. The sun is not the heating source used for bishul. So okay, this was the major task of the Gemara. They had this foresight to break the laws of the Mishnah down into something like an algorithm of God's will, so that it can be utilized in every generation to apply to a limitless amount of constantly changing scenarios, but be as accurately and authentically what God is asking you to do now as it was 3,500 years ago. That's the brilliance of the system. Now, it was what you find in the Gemara is it was generally widely debated what's the source, how does it work, and what it looks like in these scenarios. Okay? Meaning the question is, okay, what's the source? Sometimes we argue about what the source is. It's not so clear. These things were not necessarily passed down from Moshe to Yehoshua. Especially if they came later. Right? But, meaning, it could be the one person thing. I think it's learned from the Yud Gimel Midot. Well, I think it's not learn from the Yud Gimel Midot. I think it's a Gzeira Shavah. Well, I think it's this. You know, I think it's the rabbis, and this is what the rabbis said. Well, I think it's the rabbis, and that's what the rabbis said. Now, because we have these debates around the three questions, we have debates around how these laws work. Okay? So, that's what you see in the Gemara. And then what you see in the Rishonim, who came after the Gemara, is a series of different discussions, and the discussions and the arguments increase exponentially. Why? Because first they're going to debate who in the Gemara we hold by, if there are two opinions. If there's a debate in the Gemara, who do we hold by? Who do we follow? Well, that's debate number one. Right? And then, once you decide who we follow, you can debate what exactly their position is. Meaning, we both agree we follow Rav. I think Rav said this, and I think Rav said that. And then furthermore, you can debate, no, we both agree it's Rav, and we both agree what Rav said, but given this new circumstance that we have, I think in the new circumstance, Rav would have said this. No, I think in the new circumstance, Rav would have said that. That's how the debates increased exponentially from the Gemara and onward. Okay? That's primarily what we owe the multiplicity of opinions to. Following that process, every stage adds additional level of complexity in terms of working out the clarity of what God wants. Now, our axiom is that, well, while we're trying to work out what exactly God wants, as long as we follow the process, we're in the clear. That's our axiom, so to speak. What we need to understand next week is how does that work? Do we have class next week? I know there's like a Tiul in the morning, or I don't know. Okay, well, so whenever the next class is. So what we need to work out is, how can that be? How can that be that as long as we're following the process, we can get 10 different answers, and they're all fine? That's where we're, Mirza Shem, going to focus on next class.